Okay.
And the question is, should I take up
your point? Well, I think we need to deal with the whole thing. And I want to, last week we ended off in Esther 6:13. Yeah, and we talked about Haman and his wife and his friends. You know, I called you the next day.
Okay,
and deal with that seed of Abraham, and I'm sure we're going to have, I mean, seed of the Jews, of the Yehudas.
Okay.
And I'm sure we're going to have some questions on that, too.
Okay.
All righty. Thank you.
Okay.
All right, you can go.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Before we get to the point that we left off on, I just wanted to mention that we see from a careful analysis of the Book of Esther, which, as we said all along, is the model, the book that teaches perfection, the main ideas, main philosophical principles of perfection, and that's why the rabbis say that this book will always retain its sacredness even after the coming of the Messiah, even after the Messianic era, when the only thing that will be left will be the five books of Moses plus the book of Esther. So it's important that we look into every aspect that we can uncover in this great work. Now, we saw last week that Esther really was a schemer, basically. She used her incredible psychological savvy in order to be able to work on the king's mind and place him in such a state of mind where he would be caused to have anguish and a sleepless night, and that this would, she realized that that state of mind, that agitated state of mind, will bring him into a realization, give him time to reflect a little bit, and her, the fact that she called him to a meeting would exacerbate that underlying hatred that was developing, that she noticed was developing between the king and between Haman. So Haman on the outside was like a rising star, but actually beneath the surface there was tremendous tension and there was a big pull towards his ultimate downfall. The seed for his downfall was already in the making, and she noticed it. She didn't go by externals. She went by the underlying psychological state of mind of the king. And she was really a brilliant schemer. And this is again the book that teaches us the interaction between God and man, and where God, how God works with man. And God works with man not when he's just, not when he's simply passive and does nothing and just prays to God. Prayer is important, and you see that the that Esther prayed as well. But in the true philosophy of Torah, prayer is one dimension. We pray to God, that's one thing. Then we do. And scheming and understanding and knowledge and wisdom, that's what we use in order to act properly. That's what God wants us to use. And if we do that properly, then we gain his assistance. And that's precisely what happened, as we explained last week. This whole philosophy of Torah, which is contrary to the general religious philosophy. The general religious philosophy is that a person should put himself in a corner, say psalms, pray, and do nothing, and just let God take care of things. That is not the philosophy you see when you read the Old Testament. It's not the philosophy you see when you read the book of Esther. And you see a person who was a thinker and a planner. And the true philosophy of Torah, Maimonides states, he cites one verse, and that's 1 Samuel 18:14. Okay, where it says, "And David was in all his ways intelligent, maskil." Comes from the word Hebrew sechel, which means knowledge, intelligence. And the verse continues, "And God was with him." This verse summarizes the whole philosophy of Torah. That man is, God wants man to use his mind, use his intelligence to be active, and then God is with him. If a person is a maskil, if he's intelligent, brilliant, he's active, and he works in accordance with knowledge and reason, then God is with him. But if he just stays, stays and sits on the side and prays, this is not, then God will not assist him. He must act according to his knowledge and his intelligence. This is the philosophy of Torah. Different than other religious philosophies. Now, what I'd like to do is take up the points that were mentioned, one of the points that David mentioned last week, and that was Esther 6, verse 13. Okay? And it says that this is a very important verse. I mean, David has a good intuition and a keen sensitivity to the central verses, that the verses that really give out the main themes of the Book of Esther. And here it says that we find it is a strange strange verse. Why? Because it says the moment. Now you see, the king was now, the hatred that was brewing now became totally active. It became active because Haman walked in at the wrong moment. Why? Because he was overcome with his greed and with his ego. And he couldn't wait till the next morning, and he ran in the middle of the night to the king. Because he came in at that moment, and because he didn't respond properly, so the king started to turn against him, and he told him, you go and you do exactly as you said, which is give this great honor to Mordecai, but Mordecai the Jew, which means he was going against Haman. And at that moment, as we said last week, he was showing Haman, basically, that he is not for this plan of destroying the Jews, and that this plan of destroying the Jew is really serving Haman's purpose, not the king's purpose. Now, at that moment, Haman realized that this turn of events is the king is in a new gear now, and this is bad. Everything has changed. So here we find that in verse 12, and by the way, we'll come back to the verse where it says, and Mordecai returned to the gates of the king, but it says, and Haman Haman went home in a state of mourning. Okay, now it says as follows. In verse 13 it says, Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his loved ones everything that occurred to him. And then it says, and his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him that if this man is from the seed of the Jews, this Mordecai, that is, that you began to fall before him, you will not be able to prevail against him because you will surely fall before him. Okay. Now here we have a very strange kind of a statement. I mean, we find there are two discrepancies here, and let me take the minor one first, okay? The minor one is that over here, I'll take the major one first, okay? What we're trying to analyze here, we're comparing this scene with a previous scene. And take a look at the previous scene, similar scene, where Haman was so excited about his own greatness that he came home and he told his wife and his friends, his beloved one. That was just in Esther 5. Let's take a look at Esther 5, verse 10. It says, and when he saw Mordecai, he was completely filled with wrath. But then it says he contained himself in verse 10. He contained himself and he came to his house, and he called and he brought his loved ones and his wife Zeresh. And then in verse 11 it says, and Haman told them all about his great honor, his glory, and how the king had raised him higher and above all the other servants. And then in verse 12 he mentions the fact that Esther only wanted to see him at this party. And then he says, but there's one disturbing factor, this Mordecai the Jew that sits in the gates of the king. And it's important that it says Mordecai the Jew, of course. Now in verse 14, and this is the one that we really want to analyze, it says, what happened after that? So it says, Zeresh, his wife, and all his loved ones said, let us make a tree, a gallows, basically, 50 cubits high, that's about approximately 75 feet, and in the morning, tell the king, and they should hang Mordecai on this gallows. And this way you can go to the feast that you're invited, the party that you've been invited to, and you could be happy. And this appealed very much to Haman, and he made the tree, he made the gallows. Okay. Now, here we have these same advisors. Now, over here, before the beginning of his downfall, we find the advisors give him one kind of advice. They say to him, you just make a gallows and hang this Mordechai and get rid of the problem. But then the moment Haman saw that the king turned against him, then he meets with these same people, okay, and then they give him the contrary advice. They say, if this man, this Mordechai, is from the seed of the Jews that you began to fall down before him, you're not going to be able to be successful, but you will definitely continue to fall before him. Well, these are the same people. Just a while ago, they told him, just make the gallows and get rid of the whole problem, get rid of Mordechai. What kind of it's a total contradiction. What, do they gain some new kind of insight at this point? I mean, how could these same people speak out of both sides of their mouth? That's the basic question that we have to address. That's the major one. The minor one is, if you take a look, it says in 6:13, it says that Zeresh's wife and all his loved ones were with him. He told them the story, and then it says, and his wise men and his wife Zeresh said. Now, who are these wise men? Okay, now David said the wise men doesn't really mean that these were rational, great philosophical thinkers. They were kind of advisors, but usually the advisors like of a mystical kind. You see, not necessarily totally rational. But that's correct. But it's an interesting thing, and this is a point that the rabbis make. The rabbis, because you see, you have the same word chacham of wise men by Pharaoh also. When it says Pharaoh, it says he has magicians and his wise men. Now the wise men were usually like the astrologers. They weren't necessarily, doesn't necessarily mean they weren't really truly wise people. But in their frame of reference, they were the most, the best advisors. It means advisors, basically. Okay. Sometimes the word chacham means truly wise. It means a person has Torah knowledge. But sometimes the word is used in a certain context and framework, that these people in that kingdom, by Pharaoh, these people were called the advisors. They were the wisest people in the land. And over here as well, the term, and I agree with David on that, the term does not mean great, deep thinkers. It means in his framework, they were the best advisors that he had. They were his advisors. So it's a relative term, relative to his situation. They were his wise men, so to speak. Okay. But the rabbis, when they analyzed this verse, picked up on something else. And that is that, you see, we have a Masoretic fact transmitted to us through the Masorah, through the oral system. And that is that the Book of Esther, as I mentioned last time, was written in a way that mimics the Torah. So that everything was written in a way that if you read between the lines, you could discover new ideas. And over here, if we're very careful, and the main method of using that is to be extremely careful, and here's where the rabbis point out something. They say, take a look at 5:14. It says, Zeresh's wife and all those who loved him. Right? That's what it does not say wise men. Now, why is it that in Esther 6, they have, it says, and Haman told Zeresh's wife and all his loved ones, and then it says, and his wise men and Zeresh's wife said to him. So it changed from loved ones to wise men. Before, in the same group, it didn't call them wise men, it said they were loved ones. So why the discrepancy? Now, in our methods, one of the methods of analyzing the Torah is that was given to us from Sinai, that was told to us by God through Moses, is that the Torah is written in a way that every word has to be analyzed carefully. And there's no, there are no extra words, and if there's a change, there's a reason. Nothing is haphazard here. Nothing is haphazard. So when we analyze this carefully, again, we find this discrepancy, and there can't be a discrepancy. Why is it that when there's a change of a word, there's a reason for it? So we have to understand that as well. So we have two points. Okay. Now, let's take the major point first. The major point is what happened to this, what kind of a change of heart did they have, so to speak? Suddenly, this Mordechai from the seed of the Jews, if they were so afraid of the Jews, so why did they say to kill him? The answer is that what the Book of Esther is showing, this book is really teaching us something about anti-Semitism. And when I say anti-Semitism, I don't mean basically just anti-Semitism. I mean anti-people of Torah. It doesn't matter if they... I am certain that any person at that time, if there were B'nai Noach at that time, that they would be in the same state as the Jews, and no doubt Haman would have intended to destroy them as well. But the Talmud teaches us, and this is really derived from Psalms 2, when Psalms, King David asks the question, why are the nations all aroused against the Jewish people? In other words, what's the source of anti-Semitism? And he says, Ala Roshem v'al Mashicha, because they're going against God and against His Anointed One. So really, the Torah perceives that underlying, beneath the hatred for the Jew, is really a hatred towards God. Now, here is where the Book of Esther teaches us something very interesting and of great psychological significance, and that is that the hatred towards the people of God, which is the hatred of God, really, it's just on the surface, it appears like they hate the people, but this hatred against God, with that hatred goes, underneath that hatred is a certain recognition. In other words, it really is something that the person recognizes in the back of his mind that there might be some truth to God's way, and he is trying with all his might to stamp it out. So what it is there's a concept in psychology of repression. Repression means when you don't want to know about something, you push it out from your mind, and you have no more access to it. This is basically what the Book of Esther is teaching us, is that behind the hatred for the Jew is a certain recognition which was pushed out of their mind that they're fighting a greater force than the Jew, and they're really fighting God, and actually they cannot succeed. So what the Book of Esther teaches us is, and this is the source, according to the Book of Esther, according to Scripture, this is really the source of anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is, and that's why anti-Semitism is basically a sick kind of a thing. It is, anyone that's read anti-Semitic literature knows that it is pathological. It's basically ill. For instance, what's going on now with Farrakhan and this Mohammed fellow. The Jews are controlling the world. I mean, we know how false that is. The Jews have all the money. The Jews are controlling the media. I mean, this is nonsense, basically. The Jews is a drop in the bucket. Maybe for the amount, in terms of representation, that is true. In terms of representation, they are perhaps, very highly represented in the various fields. But objectively, in terms of the world, the money of the world is not in the hands of the Jews. The money of the world certainly is in the hands of the nations of the world. And this is nonsensical. When you hear these things, it's a sick mind that is speaking. Now, we know in psychology, when you try to push something out of your mind, when you try to repress something, it comes back in a sick, distorted way. And that's why anti-Semitism is an illness. This really is something that the Book of Esther reveals to us. And it reveals it to us in the same manner that the scholars of the Torah show us, the Torah reveals ideas to us, by this discrepancy. First they say, let's destroy Mordechai, make the gallows, we'll get rid of him. But then suddenly when they see that there is an ascendancy on the part of Mordechai, and that Haman is beginning to fail, then this crazy fear grips them. And then the other side of the coin, the part that they suppressed, starts coming out. Namely, that they really are fighting a force that can be successful against. And that force is in the form of the Jew, but behind that force really is God. And that is something that a person knows he cannot fight. So here, what is happening here is the Book of Esther, by showing that... Hello, I think we're having problems with the... Hello?
Yeah, we're still here.
Yeah, I know. I think we're having a problem with the phone, am I right?
Yes, you are.
Okay, it's my fault.
Hold it on. Sounds like popcorn. We thought the dog might have been holding on to the cord again.
Okay, hold on a minute. Let me switch it. Okay. So, basically, as we were saying, what the Book of Esther is teaching us is that at first they wanted to, the desire is to suppress what they're fighting, namely the ideas of the Torah, the ideas of God. But then when they started to lose, then that great fear comes out. The part that they've suppressed becomes alive and overtakes them, and they realize that against God, nobody can be successful. Which shows you that at the bottom of anti-Semitism is really a great fear. There is even a fear to recognize that they are fighting the Jew. And that is interestingly enough expressed in the very term anti-Semitism. Because anti-Semitism is not the proper term. Semites are not, the Jews are Semites, but all Semites are not Jews. So the very term anti-Semitism is a disguise. It's a refusal to recognize it really should be anti-Jew, not anti-Semitic, or anti-Israel. But the reason is because the roots of anti-Semitism, as the Book of Esther discloses, is something of a distorted nature where a person denies what he hates and why he hates it. He tries to distort and tries to fool himself into thinking that he hates these people for some other reason. The truth of the matter is he hates the people because they represent a way of life that stems from God, and they recognize this, and they are in the process of denial. The same thing is true in the very beginning of the book of Esther, where it opens up with the scene of the king and his great feast, and there the rabbis tell us that he was using when these vessels were really the vessels of the Holy Temple. Among those vessels were the vessels of the Holy Temple. Why did he use the vessels of the Holy Temple? To prove that there is no such thing as there is no power to these vessels. He was saying basically, if God is here, let him come down and destroy me. But since he doesn't, obviously this is all nonsense, and we have a right to profane these vessels, and to use them for our own personal use, and nothing happens. That means when a person acts in that way, he's fighting something that he's trying to convince himself, basically, that the world of Torah and the world of God does not exist. So behind anti-Semitism is a tremendous recognition of the Jew and a recognition, essentially, of God. And that is what happens. Now you can explain, now you can understand the two faces of the advisors and the wife of Haman. On the one hand, at first, they suppressed the idea and thought they could be successful. But the moment they saw they were losing ground, then the underlying fear takes over. And that explains the contradiction. Now, the rabbis say, as we mentioned before, David noticed that word, chachamav, his wise men. And the rabbis point to the fact that this is a discrepancy with the previous verse. So the rabbis say this teaches us something. And that is, here the Torah is trying to teach us something. Here Scripture is trying to teach us something. It's trying to teach us, I should say the Tanakh is trying to teach us, that we respect knowledge. Even in the worst people, when they say something that is true, we call them wise. And that is to teach us the philosophy of Torah. And that is that even those people were so wicked, they were the most wicked, they were basically Hitlers and Nazis, but at this point, when they came to the recognition of the truth, that you cannot fight God and you cannot fight the Jews who are the ones that have his Torah. And when they came to that recognition, that moment, reality broke forth. When reality broke forth and they spoke wisely, we call them, we give them the appellation of wise men. We praise them because they're speaking the truth. Because the Torah philosophy is that we love the truth and we respect the truth in every human being, even the most wicked person, insofar as he speaks the truth. This is something we respect. Why? Because when a person recognizes the truth, that means that he is using the divine, he's in tune, he's in line with this divine gift of God, the gift of knowledge. And when he has that gift, we respect him, even though it's a momentary respect, because basically he's evil. But we want to show how far the Tanakh shows us, the scripture shows us how far we go in respecting this wonderful, this wonderful tool that God gave us to perceive the truth. That even the most wicked person, but at that moment, due to all kinds of crazy emotions, because they saw the downfall and everything else, it wasn't due to their own perfection, but it was due to the situation. But in spite of that, at that moment, these people recognized the truth, they recognized God, and the fear of God fell upon them. Then at that moment, they spoke properly and truthfully. We call them wise. That is to teach us that we are not personally against anyone. We don't have any personal hatred towards people. If even the most evil person, he's the worst, most wicked man. But the next moment he says something true, we respect him at that moment. And that is the philosophy of Torah. Of course, this does not mean that we show leniency towards the wicked, because if the person repents, that's one thing. But if the person doesn't repent, while we can respect them for a momentary appreciation of reality, we still will destroy such an individual because they revert back to their evil ways and they are harmful to the rest of the world. And the Torah is not a liberal philosophy. The Torah's philosophy is that we destroy the evil person. We don't allow the evil person to destroy the innocent person, as we often see in our society. It's a kind of, the Torah looks at that as a misguided sympathy. The Torah does not believe in that. The Torah believes in sympathy for the good people of the earth, the innocent people, and sympathy for the wicked insofar as it is possible, as long as it doesn't harm the innocent people. But there's a system of priority over here. So that is the philosophy of Torah, and this little, what the rabbis teach us is, with their careful analysis of the text, this little change in words from the loved ones in the previous example to this one over here is a change that is based upon a concept, an idea. Okay. Should I continue, or is it time to turn the tape? Hello?
It's got about a minute, but we can, I want to set the stage for, the point that I want to make that I brought to your attention the other day. And we discussed, you dealt with the first part of it, but the second part I want to deal with is that these wise men, these soothsayers, looked, at the fact and they realized, as we said back in chapter 3 and verse 8, that as Haman went into the king, he said that this is a different people, a certain people scattered abroad. He realized that they were in the diaspora and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of that kingdom, and their laws are different from all people. Neither keep thee the king's law, therefore it is not for the king's profit. Now, you made the statement back then that they didn't keep the laws and so forth. That was his accusation. But what I was saying, that he looked at the religious practice of these people. And that's why he made that statement, and I think we need to turn the tape right now. All right. The fact that he said that, I think is what he's saying there, is that these people are different because they kept the Torah. And Mordecai and his family were keeping the Torah. Now, we have another example of that in the book of Daniel. And this is in the same time period. or excuse me, this is during the Babylonian captivity. But see, Daniel and Hananiah, Mishael and Azariah, they would not defile themselves with the king's food. So I think we have that same principle there that we have here in Esther. Now, the second thing I want to say that you dealt with the fact of anti-Semitism, and I think you did a good job there, but these wise men, Haman and his family, I contend that they saw Judaism not just as a religion, but as a race. It was a race of religion because he said of the seed of the Yehudas. Now, you want to comment on that?
Okay, I will.
Okay, go.
Yeah, that is an excellent point where he says that the seed of Judah. Now, there we see, and here you see the accuracy of the presentation of the text of Esther. And that they want to show you here that the anti-Semite, even when he sees that he can't be successful, his recognition is still in a mystical kind of terms. He doesn't really perceive the true idea. The reason why he really can't succeed is because God is not allowing him to. But he somehow attaches it to this mystical seed of the Jew. Now, we know very well that there's nothing per se. It's really the ideology of the Jew, not the seed of the Jew. For instance, as I mentioned many times, Rabbi Akiva was probably one of the greatest, without a doubt, one of the greatest scholars of all times. And Rabbi Akiva's father was a convert, and so was Rabbi Meir's, and so were the teachers of Hillel and Shammai. So it is not a biological concept. Torah is an ideological concept, and it is an identification with the personalities of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, without a doubt. And there's no doubt that's where the concept of the seed comes in, which we've spoken about many times, that God realized that in order to have the philosophy continue, people must identify with the philosopher as a progenitor. And that's why Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That is correct. But you see here that these soothsayers, as David said, or advisors, that even when they recognized the truth, it still wasn't proper and was not accurate. It was in mystical terms, which shows you that once a person is in the wrong framework, even if he sees something that's true, it's still distorted, hazy, blurry. It's not the real clear idea. The real reason, what they really should have said, is that the reason why you can't be successful is because you're going against God, God's Torah, and God's providence. That was the real reason. But that level they weren't on. But nevertheless, they were on the track, and therefore the rabbis say that we gave them the compliment. We give the text of Esther, the book of Esther. Scripture gives them the compliment of using the appellation wise men over here. But I think that's a very valid point that David mentioned about the fact that it's in a distorted form, even though there is a basic recognition, but you cannot really see reality clearly if you spend your life in a distorted mental framework. Okay. What I like to mention also that David mentioned before, where the attack against the Jewish people, which is an attack against the people who believe and keep the laws of the Torah. And the attack is that their laws are different. You'll always notice it. Their laws are different. Now, the truth of the matter is that this attack is always lodged against the Jewish people because they are different, because their laws really have nothing in common with pagan concepts or with other kind of primitive idolatrous concepts. And the world has always recognized that, and the world really still recognizes that today, whether they admit to it openly or not. But the underlying is, again, the Torah believes that there is a person can know something in an underlying fashion in his mind, in the back of his mind, where he doesn't really readily recognize it, but it's there somehow or other, a certain kind of knowledge. And that is true. But the point that Haman was making, you see, what was really different about the Jew, and this is interesting, the Jew historically, and this is something that the king Ahasuerus started to notice. You see, we have to ask a question. Was Ahasuerus a bad man or a good man? Now, when you read the text of the Book of Esther, superficially, you get the impression, and many people say, a jolly old king. But the rabbis, when they analyze it carefully, and through the tradition that we have from the writers of the text itself down, it turns out that they did not believe that. That Ahasuerus was considered a wicked man. As a matter of fact, the rabbis say in the beginning of the book where it says he is Ahasuerus, when it says he's Ahasuerus, that's not an extra term. It meant to say he is the same Ahasuerus from the beginning to the end. He was wicked when he started, and he was wicked at the end. He died a wicked man. He never became a virtuous man. So you'll ask me, well, what do you mean? He saved all the Jews. Well, the rabbis say when you look at the text carefully, you see he was a vicious man. He was an anti-Semite himself. Because when Haman made the proposal to Ahasuerus to destroy the Jewish people, Ahasuerus was so happy, he even went along with him and helped him out. Because, take a look at the verse where it says, where you had this dialogue between the king and between Haman. And that's the one that David was referring to in Esther 3, verse 8, where Haman says that there is a nation that is scattered among the people, and they have different laws. Now he says, and in verse 9 he says, I personally will bring to the king's treasury a large sum of money. And what does it say in verse 10? That the king took off his ring and he gave it to Haman. What does taking off the ring signify? What do you have to take off the ring for? What did he just say? Okay, go ahead. He took off the ring was he made him in charge of this program, and he gave him power. Giving the ring to the king is giving over power. He was excited about this prospect of destroying the Jews, so excited that he made Haman in charge of the project, and he even made him a great official. He gave him specific power, and he made him the vizier of the king because he came up with this evil idea. So he was excited about it. As a matter of fact, the king said, the money's given to you. He didn't even accept the money from Haman in verse 11. And he says, and do whatever you want in your eyes. Now, this is certainly a man that has hatred towards these people himself. But he didn't know how to get out the hatred because, you know, you have to realize, and we must, when we look back in the past, we must realize that they lived in as real a situation politically as we do. We often think we apply fairy tale notions to the past. But you have to realize, here was a king, he hated these Jews that were scattered among this kingdom just as much as Haman did. The only thing is that he couldn't do anything about it because you can't just kill your subjects because then what are the people going to say? The Nazis had their own way of accomplishing that. The king didn't know what to do. But when Haman made this presentation, and Haman had it worked out, the specifics, how to go about it, how to work it out, how to do it, so the king was so excited, he said, forget the money, the money's given to you. Don't give me the money, I don't need the money. And he even raised them to a higher position because of that and made this a whole program in his kingdom. So the rabbis say, when you look at these verses in Esther 3, you see that Ahasuerus was a wicked man, an anti-Semite, a hater of the Jew. Now, what happened to him? What did he become? He suddenly became virtuous, became righteous, he repented? No, the rabbis say he never repented. He was still the same hedonistic person that he was as described in the orgiastic scene in the beginning of the Book of Esther. But what happened to him was as follows. He became extremely frightened when he saw that Haman, that night, that sleepless night, brought to his realization that this man Haman is an egomaniac, and he's trying to become the leader of the people. I'm being put in the background, and he's arming the masses, and what he's going to do is he's going to take over. So he realized that this, at first he thought he was his buddy, he joined in the hatred of the Jew, but then he realized that he is joining hands with the most dangerous individual that he could in his kingdom. Because this Haman is out for one thing, power, not only power, he wants to be worshipped, to people to bow down to him, to believe that he has supernatural powers. This man's a maniac. This is someone who's the most dangerous person. He's not an ally. So when Ahasuerus realized it that night, and that's really what the Book of Esther is trying to teach us, when he had that realization, he started to think to himself very seriously that as a king, his protection is the people, because the most powerful king depends upon the people, and if the people aren't loyal, he's dead, basically. So therefore, he started to think about all the people that did favors for him that there was no compensation for, and he remembered Mordechai the Jew. Now, what went through his mind that night with Mordechai the Jew? What he came to realize is this. You see, he disliked the Jew for a different reason than Haman did. Haman disliked the Jew because Haman was basically an egomaniac. He wanted to be worshipped as something unusual, something special. A Hitlerian, really, he was a Hitler, basically. What was Hitler? The essence of Hitler was that he was a super race, Superman. That's what Haman wanted to be, a Superman. And he recognized that the Jews will never accept such an idea. There are no supermen, no heroes. There's only one hero, God. So he hated the Jews because of that. You see, Achashverosh hated the Jew on a less personal level. He hated a Jew. He's basically a hedonistic person. He was a pagan, a hedonistic person that was a pleasure-loving individual, pleasure-seeking, women, wine, parties. That was what he wanted. He was like an orgiastic man. That's what he was. That was his whole life. Now, he hated the Jews for a different reason, because the Jews had a philosophy that was against the hedonistic way of life. They believed that there are certain vessels that can't be used for your own pleasure, that these vessels are designated to the temple to be used in a way that brings man closer to God, this abstract God that we can't see, and that we don't indulge in lust. We enjoy life, but our energies essentially are directed towards the appreciation and recognition of God and studying His law, studying the Torah. This is a philosophy which is anti-hedonistic. So Ahasuerus hated the Jew for a different reason than Haman. He didn't want to be worshipped as a Superman, as we said last time. When he wanted to show how great he was, he showed people concrete proofs that he's great. And he enjoyed praise. He enjoyed that too. But he was basically a hedonistic person. And the hedonistic way of life is against the Torah way of life. That causes hatred, no doubt. But it's not a hatred that can't be overcome. Haman's hatred was intrinsic, because the Torah is against his whole idea that he wants to be God, and the Torah does not allow him. That's the Superman concept. That's really the philosophy of Amalek, is the Superman Hitler type of idea, which Haman basically was exactly the same. When you study Haman, the more you study about Haman, and the more the Midrashim you read about Haman, Haman and Hitler are basically synonymous. Same personalities. Now, Haman, you understand, so therefore Haman went to the king, and there was a merger between the hedonist and between the person that hated the Jew because of his egomania. But what happened was that the hedonist suddenly realized that he's joining hands with this egomaniac, but this guy's going to kill him. This man will destroy him. And then he remembered the Jew, really, is not so terrible. After all, who saved his life? Mordechai. Now, I can tell you that throughout history, if you just read the history of the Jew, you will see that the Jew is notoriously loyal to the kingdoms or the governments that he is involved with. Notoriously loyal. Happens to be a fact, happens to be true. Throughout history. And this is exemplified in the story of Esther, where who was the one that, when these two people were plotting to destroy the king, who was the one that that went behind the scenes and went to Esther and revealed the plot and saved the king's life? That was Mordechai. Why? Because the Jew believes one of the principles of Torah is, as a matter of fact, it's found in the ethics of the fathers, is that you should always pray for the peace, for the security of the government within which you reside. Because even though it has faults, and even though it has flaws, and the kingdom of Ahasuerus had flaws, no question about it. But you see, Mordechai, in spite of the flaws, saved the king's life. Because this is a philosophy of Torah. That a kingdom, even if it's bad, even if it has serious evils, it still is better than no government at all. That's why it says in the Ethics of the Fathers that you should pray for the peace of the government, because without government, one man will swallow up another person, which means anarchy is worse than even a deficient and bad government. That's the philosophy of the Torah, philosophy of the Jew. And the Jew has always been notoriously loyal. I think especially of one case, Samuel Hanagid. He was in Spain, and at that time Granada was a separate kingdom, and he was a vizier for the king Cubas, the early 11th century. Now, he was the vizier for the king, he was the commander-in-chief for the king, and the king loved him, basically. I mean, even though at that time there were many Arabs that were very envious of him, but he was an unbelievable politician and diplomat and statesman, and he even disarmed the hatred of the Arabs that were very envious of his position. But he basically ran the government, and the king recognized this, that this man was responsible, made him, actually. The Jew has always been loyal. Ferdinand and Isabella, before the Inquisition, they expelled the Jews from Spain. Who was the financier of Spain? It was Don Isaac Abarbanel. And as a matter of fact, the famous story that before the expulsion of the Jews from Spain, Don Isaac Abarbanel went to Ferdinand and Isabella, and he said, "I have a new plan that will enrich Spain tenfold. I'll do more for them than I ever did before. Just do not spare the Jews. Don't send them out of Spain." And Torquemada at that moment walked in with a cross and went to Isabella and Ferdinand and said, "Are you going to sell him for 30 pieces of silver?" So then they went on with the expulsion. And on the same day that Columbus was in his ship in 1492, setting sail, he looked out of his window and he saw the Jews leaving Spain en masse with their packs on their backs, you know, with nothing but their themselves and their families, and they were lucky to get away with that, actually. But the Jew, basically, Don Isaac Abarbanel, by the way, was the financier of Spain. He was the greatest mind in terms of running the country. But it didn't help. It didn't help, because once this insane hatred starts, then no matter what you do isn't good. But there have been men throughout history, kings and men in great power positions, that recognize that the Jew is really the best ally. He loves the government. As a matter of fact, the kings in Spain, they liked the Jews because they knew the Jew doesn't have any aspirations to be king. He doesn't want to be king. The Samuel Hanagid, who helped King Cubas, he had no aspirations to be king. As a matter of fact, in his spare time, he used to give Talmudic lectures, and he was a great genius, by the way. His works in Talmud are world-renowned. His essential, I mean, when I say in his spare time, it seems that he spent much of his time in Talmud. I don't just mean a small amount of time. I say spare time because I can't imagine. The man was vizier for the king. He was also the commander-in-chief of the armies, military forces. He was a general, the biggest general. And at the same time, he was giving classes in Talmud. These people, when I look at their lives sometimes, I'm amazed at how they could pack so much into one day. I mean, the way their days were, their time was, their energies were being drawn in all directions. But throughout history, there were people that recognized that the Jew is the safest thing, because he's not interested in becoming king, because it doesn't mean anything to him. He wants to study Torah. He wants to give classes in Talmud. And he wants to be safe so that he and his people can be safe. That's all he wants. And this realization is what came to the king Ahasuerus in the middle of the night. It wasn't that he changed and became a righteous person. The Talmud is right. The Talmud says, no, he was an evil man from the beginning to the end. Evil means he was always hedonistic. But he became intelligently hedonistic. He realized that to make Mordecai his ally is a much more intelligent move than Haman. Haman's a sick man. This man thinks he's God. So he's a dangerous man. Whereas Mordecai, who saved my life? Mordecai is the one that saved my life. He's loyal to the king. So he doesn't hero worship me. He doesn't think that I'm the greatest man in the world. He thinks a Talmudic scholar is greater than me. So what? So let him think that way. Does it bother me? But he's the one that could give me security. He's the one that will really help me in my government. And that was the revelation that came through to Ahasuerus, who was a hedonist, when he started to think about what's happening, and he started to think about these two personalities. And that's what caused the turn of events. That's what caused the turn of events. Of course, with God's intervention, that Haman walked in at the precise moment, and the way everything worked out, that's what caused the turn of events. But this is basically what went on in King Ahasuerus' mind. Okay. Now, what I want to mention now is I just want to follow up with the storyline over here. That, oh yeah, by the way, I wanted to mention something else. According to halacha, by the way, and this is a halacha, states that if Jews are under a king and the Jew does not pay taxes, he is considered a slave. And this is a matter of halacha. The king can enslave him physically. And he can redeem himself if he pays what he owes. But if he doesn't, he's considered a slave. Now, this is an amazing thing. Where do you find a nation that has their own religion, their own system, and yet they recognize an extraneous government, a secular government, to the extent that if a person is disloyal and doesn't pay the proper taxes to that government, he is physically considered a slave. And this is a matter of halacha. So the truth of the matter is that the Jew, with his laws, turns out to be, if he keeps his laws, he's the most loyal subject. He is the most loyal citizen, the most patriotic citizen that anyone can expect to have. There's only one thing he will not give, and that is hero worship to the people and the government that he's in. He has his hero worship is only God and the people, the Talmudic scholars that reflect God's ideas. They are the ones that he respects, and they're the ones he turns to for knowledge, and they're the ones that guide his life. And they're responsible for a life he only gets for one thing, a life that is different because he follows God's laws and God's Torah, which is intrinsically different than any other philosophy, any other way of life. That is true. What Haman said was true. Their laws are different. But he used that to cast aspersion on the Jew. And people, of course, when someone's different, they can't identify with them psychologically, so they can release their hatred upon the Jew. So he used that as a backdrop to be able to release the hatred against the Jew. But the truth of the matter is, and of course, he used a true statement. And no one really does anything if you can't accomplish. Even hatred you cannot accomplish if you do it stupidly. I mean, he was very intelligent. He used true things. You must use the truth. So, but then with the truth, you throw in the distortion. That's every person that accomplished anything evil knows that principle. And that principle is displayed clearly here in the Megillah. And now what I'd like to do is just follow up the storyline. And following up the storyline, we mentioned last week about how that fateful day when Haman was at the party, and we said that the king left the room. This was also a divine providence. How the king left the room, and then when he came back, he sees Haman on the bed with Esther. Of course, he was pleading for his life, but that vision was the worst thing, because at that moment it looked like he was going to take over. And we mentioned in the olden days that when a king would take over the throne of another king, he would immediately take the queen. Capturing the queen was a sign of conquest. But there's something else that I failed to mention last time, and that is there's another thing here, and that is that really reminded him. The rabbis tell us that also reminded him of something else, that Haman was the one that was responsible for the death of his first queen, and that was the Queen Vashti, if you remember. And here he saw the two of them together, this also brought to his mind the hatred that he had buried in his heart against Haman. You remember that incident, how Haman jumped to give the solution, and the rabbis backed out because they saw that this is not a good, they can't win in this no-win situation. But Haman wanted to give advice. He was eager. So he ran, and he gave advice. And it cost him, because, as we said, he was building up a debt, and Ahasuerus, the king, was harboring the hatred in his heart, that he, down deep, he felt angry at him because he took away his first queen. So now he saw, when Queen Esther revealed to him, and that was the amazing thing, was that she never revealed the nation that she was from until that moment, until they met at the second party. Now, that was, it turned out that was extremely important, because when she revealed what nation she belongs to, and then she said that Haman wants to kill me. So therefore, the hatred, this brought back the whole hatred that he already harbored against Haman for killing his first wife. And now he finds out that Esther's a Jew, and according to Haman's decree, Haman is going to just take away his second wife. This was intolerable. You see, this was intolerable. So there were many threads here that came together. And the Torah teaches us an interesting principle in human psychology. And as I said, the Torah is a combination of the most profound psychology and philosophy of any work that there is in existence, because it's God's work. And the Torah teaches us over here, and even though this was written by the prophets, wasn't written by God, but nevertheless, these are people that have had access to God, to the true understanding of God's Torah and the ideas of Torah, God's ideas. So that's why it's scripture. Now, what they're teaching us here is an interesting thing, and I think if you look around, I think you'll notice that it's true also, and that is that when a person makes a decision, a human being makes a decision, it's very strange. The decision he makes is usually more powerful, with more conviction, if he has many reasons than if he has one reason. As a matter of fact, even many bad reasons, and I think a good lawyer knows this, that you're better off with many bad reasons to convince a jury than with one good one. One good one is one reason. A person feels like that's not enough. But when you have many reasons, people are very quick. Well, it's this, it's that, it's this, oh, there's 10 reasons here. None of them are any good. But it doesn't matter. No one really thinks beyond the surface. And anything that sounds good, immediately they say, well, there's 10 reasons. This must be right. One good reason is not enough. And that's another principle of psychology that the Book of Esther is teaching us, and that is that when the wrath of Ahasuerus turned against Haman, it was really because of many reasons came together, many reasons. The reason that Haman really was responsible for the death of his first wife, the reason that Haman was asking people to bow down to him, he was claiming supernatural powers, you see. The reason that Haman, when he broke into the room that night, he immediately started to say how much glory the king should give to that person. The king obviously realized that he's thinking it's him, and what does he have the audacity to think that way? You see, and then the scene on the at the bedside where he looks like he's trying to conquer the queen, which again brought out the fact that he's a dangerous man. What the Book of Esther is doing is it's teaching us.
Rabbi, we got 60 seconds.
Okay. It's showing you there were many threads that were coming together, you see. That's what the book is trying to teach us. Many threads that were coming together in the mind of this Ahasuerus. And that's why it was so powerful, and that's why the decree was so powerful, so intense, and so swift. Because it was really determined by many factors. And a human being is of such a psychological nature that when many factors, these were all good factors, even those we said before, a lot of them were inconclusive. There were suspicions. But many suspicions are even better than one fact. Okay, what we'll take up next week is how did the king bring about this? This is an important question. How could the king suddenly change his mind? After all, he's running a tremendous government here. You don't just come out one day and say, hey, now I'm... just a moment, folks. Now we're praising the Jews. Yesterday we were going to kill them. You can't look like a maniac. How did he bring that about? That's the question that we have to take up. That's one of the questions we have to take up next week. Okay, we'll stop here, okay?